loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we talk about an underreported aspect of Facebook's drive to control the content shared on its platform, the suppression of pages advocating for the rights of Palestinians. We're going to be talking to Max Blumenthal, journalist and author, about a breaking story in great investigative journalism by a Gray Zone project. And then again today, we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to the midterm elections in November.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in-depth in the second hour. First, a new tranche of U.S. sanctions against Russia will take effect on Monday, including prohibitions on loans, weapons, and dual-use items. The sanctions will remain in place for at least 1 year. Next, Special Counsel Robert Mueller has given Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg immunity as part of the investigation into Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen. And Weisselberg isn't the only person granted immunity. National Enquirer publisher David Pecker has also received a guarantee of immunity. The news appears to be tightening around the White House, but what is the thrust of the investigation now that it has nothing to do with Russia? Then, it has been nearly a month since a federal court ordered the Trump administration to reunite separated immigrant families, but hundreds of children are still waiting for reunification. In fact, according to the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU, some 565 children are still being held in detention away from their parents. And then, Houthi rebels reported that Saudi warplanes attacked a village outside of Hodeidah in Yemen yesterday, killing at least 30 people, including 22 children. The dead had fled an earlier Saudi bombing. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll take a look at the week's worst and most misleading headlines. And in other headlines, President Trump has instructed Secretary of State Pompeo to cancel his upcoming trip to North Korea. While Trump tweeted that there was insufficient progress made in the talks between the two countries, he focused primarily on the role of China. He tweeted, quote, "Additionally, because of our much tougher trading stance with China, I do not believe they are helping with the process of denuclearization as they once were." Secretary Pompeo looks forward to going to North Korea in the near future, most likely after our trading relationship with China is resolved. In the meantime, I would like to send my warmest regards and respect to Chairman Kim. The U.S. Navy announced today that it was reactivated the Second Fleet, tasked with patrolling the Atlantic Ocean. Admiral Chris Greedy explained that the move was motivated by the perception that, quote, "our sea control and power projection, two vital elements of our national security, are being challenged by resurgent foreign powers, namely Russia and China," unquote. The Second Fleet had been deactivated in 2011. The Trump administration attacked the government of El Salvador in a statement today, signed by Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. El Salvador, which is governed by the left-wing FMLN, recently cut ties with Taiwan in favor of establishing relations with China. Sanders wrote, quote, "The El Salvadoran government's receptiveness to China's apparent interference in the domestic politics of a Western Hemisphere country is of grave concern to the U.S. and will result in a reevaluation of our relationship with El Salvador." Zimbabwe's Supreme Court has upheld the election victory of President Emmerson Mnangagwa. The court was considering a challenge brought by opposition leader Nelson Chamisa, who alleged fraud. In the election held last month, Mnangagwa won 51% of the vote, while Chamisa won 44%. These are today's headlines, and you are listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
First, we turn to a story about how Facebook is suppressing websites and Facebook pages that are pro-Palestinian. Facebook is being accused of creating an entirely new level of censorship, deleting posts and whole pages, blocking content, and restricting access to news. The mainstream media has decried Facebook's censorship of conservative sites like Prager University and InfoWars, but Facebook has also deleted pages associated with Bernie Sanders followers and Black Lives Matter. What the media are not talking about, however, is Facebook's censorship of pages and news advocating for the Palestinian cause or the rights of Palestinian people or for peace in the Middle East. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project, and the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max Blumenthal, welcome back.
Great to be back.
This is really amazing investigative journalism that you and Hamza Raza have conducted. People can read this article on your website, grayzoneproject.com. The title is Meet the Owner of Canary Missions Anonymous Anti-Palestinian Blacklisting Website. Talk about what you wrote about, what you discovered, and its importance.
Well, what we discovered, basically through documents passed to us, is that the person who registered Canary Mission's website, and I'll explain the significance of Canary Mission for your listeners in a second, who registered the website in February 2015 is an American lawyer who's been very involved in advocacy for Israel, who's involved in high tech and medicine in Israel, named Howard David Sterling, kind of a previously unknown figure. He has some videos online where he's boasting about Israel's medical achievements. And he registered Canary Mission on GoDaddy back in February 2015, which is when we know that the site was registered. What's significant about it is that we finally have a name connected to the website. I've been in touch with a family member of Sterling's who denies that he's the owner, but when I confronted this family member with the fact that the registration form is tied to his name and address, the family member said, well, they just don't know how that could have happened. And I don't know how it happened because I actually do know who the operational players are behind Canary Mission, and I'm not at liberty to reveal it because there are a variety of factors. Sterling does not appear to be one of the operational figures behind it, but this is clear evidence that he did register the site. I think that this could possibly open up some opportunities for students who have been blacklisted on this website to seek accountability, because we now have firm evidence of someone who's behind it. Now, why this is important is because ever since Canary Mission emerged in 2015, the website has maintained total anonymity, and that has given it impunity to smear and blacklist literally hundreds of students and Palestine solidarity activists, posting their personal information, even inventing or spitting statements that those students made on social media with the expressed intent of denying those students employment after college or getting them interrogated when they attempt to visit family inside Palestine because they have to pass through Israel's frontiers, whether at the airport or at the, for example, Allenby border crossing, where they'll be interrogated by Israeli security personnel. And in one case, a student has actually been pulled out of class at Seton Hall Law and interrogated by the FBI as a result of social media posts he made that appeared on Canary Mission. His name is Ahmad Abu Ras. And so I think for the first time, we're going to start seeing some accountability for this malicious McCarthyite blacklisting site. But as I said, I don't think Howard Sterling is the major figure behind it. There is a network that I think goes all the way to Israeli intelligence, which is behind this website and which is directing it on a day-to-day basis. And it's part of a stepped-up, increasingly aggressive campaign to defeat the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, particularly in the United States.
It's hard to overstate the desire by this website to create not just a chilling effect, but an atmosphere of absolute intimidation against individuals who are involved in a just cause, the cause to end apartheid, the cause to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel because of its apartheid practices. The headline at the top is, "If you're racist, the world should know." And then it's a list of all of these individuals all over the country. Then a list of all the professors. I mean, you know, when you're a professor, either you're in tenure, you have tenure, or you're in tenure track, or you're seeking tenure track, or you're an adjunct, if you've said anything in support of Palestine or the BDS movement, you could have your profile there and your name and your
information. And then it's career ending.
And that's the point. And then the list of organizations. And on the front page, there's a big thing about anti-Semitism at George Washington University exposed. I mean, I'm looking at that right now, and I'm looking at the pictures of the students. Well, guess what? Because we're here in Washington, we know all these people. They're good people. They're not anti-Semites. They're against all forms of racism or Islamophobia or anti-Semitism. But they're standing up for Palestinians. And there they are. They're like mugshots on this website.
Yeah. There is a focus on George Washington University right now. I'll get to that in a second. Basically, Canary Mission moves through different schools, and it operates in a very strategic manner, which suggests that this is not just a group of rogue individuals, sitting in a basement somewhere, and that it has connections to both private and state intelligence, and that it is operating with impunity because of the anonymity it enjoys. I actually have a friend in town who I met when I was on a speaking tour on campuses in Florida. He was the director of the Florida State Students for Justice in Palestine. And he's now a public school teacher in Jersey City. His name is Nathaniel Wallace. And he wound up on Canary Mission. And Canary Mission had attempted to contact Jersey City school administrators to get him fired simply because he had years ago been involved in campus activism. So he currently wasn't very active in Palestine solidarity circles. But this is how vindictive and malicious this site is, that they were seeking to deprive Jersey City schools of a really talented teacher who is working in an underfunded school district. Hamza Raza, my co-author on this article, has been on Canary Mission with 60 photographs and postings of him basically making basic statements in support of Palestinian equal rights. I don't think he said anything particularly inflammatory. There have also been people like Catherine Frank, who is a professor at Columbia University, who was deported from Israel. And it appears that it was because of her Canary Mission profile. Pretty much anyone who's involved in Palestine solidarity will be wind up on this website, except for maybe me, because, you know, I'm on every other website. And if you just Google my name, it'll basically say that I'm the spawn of Satan. So there's no point. It's kind of superfluous to put me on the website. But mostly it focuses on students. And when you look at, you know, just take a look at who's on there, it's mostly students of color. It's mostly people from marginalized communities who don't have legal recourse, who might just become intimidated because of the oppression they already face, and become afraid of law enforcement. Many students have attempted to recant their Palestine solidarity activism, and Canary Mission features a section. This is extremely totalitarian, where the students have basically confessed and atoned, and Canary Mission officially forgives them. And so it's like there's this big brother who's lording over anyone who decides that maybe people shouldn't be shot down in the Gaza Strip for trying to march out of the cage that they're trapped in. Now, I'd mentioned George Washington University. This is a particularly interesting case. They passed a divestment resolution at George Washington University. That means to divest from corporations that are involved in the occupied territories of Palestine. So basically, you know, you could even be for a two-state solution and favor this divestment resolution. It's not that extreme. This is what's going on campuses across the country. And the GW students started to face not just attacks on Canary Mission, but attacks on Facebook. And on Facebook, there was an Israeli app, which you can download on your phone. It was created in Israel, called ACT.IL. IL is the Israeli kind of online country code. And that app was directing users to attack the students and putting their personal profiles on Facebook and any personal information. And so basically they were getting swarmed by an Israeli app. That app was actually funded, its creation was funded by Sheldon Adelson, who is one of the largest donors to Benjamin Netanyahu's political empire, as well as to Donald Trump's political campaign. And he's also responsible for Trump's funding Trump's Iran policy. This is one of the most influential pro-Israel billionaires in the world. And that app really traces back to Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which is now headed by someone named Sima Vaknin Gil, who's one of the most dangerous and important figures in the Israeli government that you've never heard of, who used to be a high-ranking officer with Israel's Shin Bet, what's known as Shabak in Israel, its General Security Services. In other words, the Israeli spying agency. And so you have state intelligence basically churning out these apps, working to monitor Palestine solidarity activity in the U.S., and then the apps directing trolls to attack students who are otherwise defenseless and generally from marginalized social groups in the U.S. And that's the Israeli government strategy, working through these cutouts. And I believe the Canary Mission is one such cutout.
We're speaking with Max Blumenthal. Max is an award-winning journalist, author, filmmaker, about the work that he's done with Gray Zone Project to uncover, to unmask the anonymous site Canary Mission. When I'm looking at this website, I mean, you have Medea Benjamin from Code Pink.
It's pretty amazing.
You have all of these people who are part of the peace movement. No one can look at this site and not consider it to be simply a way to drive people out of public discourse on an important issue. And I'm just wondering, Max, how does the rest of the pro-Israeli movement or organizations or institutions or infrastructure, how do they view Canary Mission?
That's a really good question, and it helps us also understand further who might be involved with Canary Mission. Many of the more institutional mainline pro-Israel groups initially came out and supported it until they were forced to confront how malicious this operation was. One is the Anti-Defamation League, which is, you know, I think one of the major pro-Israel groups. It parades itself as kind of a Jewish civil rights group, but it's basically a pro-Israel intimidation group. And it during the 1980s, the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, actually monitored anti-apartheid activists who were fighting for justice in South Africa. It continues to monitor Palestine solidarity activists. It infiltrates rallies and meetings. But Canary Mission had gone too far for the ADL. And the ADL, which does have a largely liberal constituency, condemned it as an Islamophobic hate site. So that was significant. The American Jewish Committee, which has links to, you know, works with the State Department, is very mainstream, and also, you know, ferociously supportive of the Israeli government, condemned Canary Mission. There was one group which was previously a small group that was sort of unknown called the Israel on Campus Coalition, which now has a massive budget and is spearheading a lot of the activity we see on campus and is an umbrella group for many of the hardcore right-wing pro-Israel groups that are very getting very active under Trump, like Christians United for Israel, the evangelical right-wing group, and the Zionist Organization of America, whose director, Morton Klein, has been one of Trump's biggest Jewish defenders. This group has openly supported Canary Mission. It's headed by someone named Jacob Baim, who is a young pro-Israel operative. And what this group does is monitor Palestine solidarity activity through sophisticated high-tech methods. They claim to kind of have a high-tech war room, and they claim that they can detect any Facebook posts supportive of Palestine on any of the student group's social media channels, and then immediately flood the internet with responses. And this group is funded by someone named Adam Milstein, another very significant funder in the pro-Israel movement who isn't as well known as Adelson. He's based out of LA. He's an Israeli-American. And he has, I mean, if you look at his own social media accounts, he's just like vociferously Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, very right-wing. But I think that we'll be learning a lot more about the Israel on Campus Coalition's connections to Canary Mission and the importance of learning who these who's connected to Canary Mission and really nailing who's behind it is that we have to get accountability for these students so that they can start fighting back and protecting themselves against this malicious operation, which I really think is at the heart of the Israeli government strategy to drive down a movement for Palestinian equal rights in this country.
Yeah, I think Max is right, because if you look back at the last, say, 15, 16 years, the tide is turning. At one time, it was almost impossible to get a hearing if you were speaking in behalf of the Palestinian peoples and people on the on behalf of the Palestinian people's right of return, documenting Israeli crimes against humanity or Israeli war crimes, even within the left. Back in 2002, my organization, the Answer Coalition, was with other anti-war groups, and we were organizing a demonstration for April 20th, 2002. The Israelis reinvaded the West Bank in the end of March after, you know, Blair and Bush gave the green light. And we insisted that the demonstration focus on Palestine, and there was a split. The two groups went in different directions down on the mall. It turned out 75,000 people came to the demonstration that was, in fact, in support of Palestine. Only 15,000 came for the other one. And it was a sort of a shifting moment where it suddenly became okay to be pro-Palestinian. It always had been okay to be against apartheid in South Africa or to support the freedom of people in Nicaragua or El Salvador or Vietnam, but Palestine was taboo. That tide started slowly to shift. And now we have BDS, Boycott, Divest, Sanctions Movement, which is considered by the Israeli government to be, you know, a fundamental existential threat because it could rally public opinion in a peaceful protest to do things that would be economically harmful to the Israeli state unless because of its apartheid practices. And so now, Max, we have this out-and-out kind of, maybe terror is too strong of a word, but it certainly is a kind of super intimidation tactic that, if allowed to stand, would I could see it really having a chilling impact for professors, say, who have to make decisions. Do I lend my name? Do I sign up? Do I sponsor a meeting? So we have to fight back. I mean, we have to. What you've done is help expose it, but people really do have to take practical action to say, look, this isn't acceptable. This doesn't comport with any sort of democratic concept of free speech. There has to be fight back here.
Yeah, there has to be fight back, and there also has to be, you know, some courage. People have to be willing to step up and pay and face the consequences, and also consider the fact that, you know, when Palestinians inside the Gaza Strip, for example, face the consequences, they're actually taking bullets. They're taking live bullets. So, you know, maybe it might cost you a job, but the question is, how much does this matter to you? 1,000 professors and academics have signed a letter condemning Canary Mission, and those academics are putting themselves on the line.
Indeed.
Other people need to kind of put their names out there in support of these students who never had a choice, but whom, and many of them didn't have a choice to be involved in Palestine solidarity activism because they're Palestinians whose family members are living in de facto cages. I agree with you, though, Brian, that we have been at a turning point. The Israel lobby is losing. Liberal support is fading away fast from Israel. Israel's becoming a Republican issue. It's increasingly becoming an evangelical issue where non-Jews are the base of support in the U.S. And that's why we're seeing these smash mouth, vicious tactics. So people need to keep that in mind. What's dismaying to me is that the Israel on Campus Coalition has detected a 50% drop in divestment resolutions on campus. And these resolutions are so important for getting a debate going on campus. I remember being the guest speaker at the University of Michigan's divestment hearing in 2015. At the real high point of these hearings, there was a line around the block to fill this giant auditorium for a debate on BDS and basically a debate on Israeli apartheid. We had 650 students in the room. People got educated. They got to hear from Palestinians. I got to speak for a half hour. It was live streamed. Thousands of people got to see it. And I think it's because of these intimidation tactics, in part, that the divestment hearings aren't happening as much. And so people really need to step up and defend these students. But it's also important to do journalism. I think we're going to be seeing at Electronic Intifada and at the Gray Zone Project and at other sites more about Canary Mission, more on who's behind it. The mask is lifting. And I just want to say to anyone who's involved with Canary Mission that accountability is coming your way soon.
Yeah, it's extremely important. If we have a passive response, which is the opposite of what Max and others are suggesting, they win. But if we, people who believe in justice for Palestine, stand with Palestine, want to right this wrong, see an injustice solved, and are not afraid, not intimidated, stand up, we can win. And that's always been the case. And you mentioned the people in Palestine, it's hard for them to stand up because they're taking bullets, not just losing a job. You think back to the civil rights movement in the South, people in the most, you know, backward places and most difficult places, say Montgomery, Alabama, where Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. I mean, people were faced with all kinds of terror, real terror, and yet they stood up. And once they stood up, they were able to change history. Max, in the last 2 minutes, tell us, just for our audience, maybe they're driving, they're listening to the show, they're hearing about this for the first time. What is BDS and why is it so important to the Israeli authorities and to the Palestinian people?
Well, BDS is the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. And basically, it is a Palestinian-created movement that emerged out of Palestinian civil society at a really dark time after Israel built its separation wall in and around the West Bank. And Palestinians, and particularly the U.S.-created Palestinian Authority, was powerless to do anything. So basically, 180 or so Palestinian groups got together and said, we need something to deter Israel so that it can't do more to cage us in. BDS started to spread in Europe, in the United States. It started to spread on campus. Boycotts were called of products made at Israeli settlements, like the Ahava beauty product. It started to frighten not just Israeli manufacturers, but you know the Israeli military itself, because gear that it used, like Motorola, Caterpillar, were falling under the ban. But more importantly, it became a mechanism for educating people. Divestment drives woke up so many Jewish students on campus. It became a real platform for people like me to get our work out and to go around the mainstream media and talk about our journalism and talk about our work. And I think it's really the only game in town when we have a government in Washington that is still providing bipartisan support to an apartheid machine that has just formally ratified apartheid through a Knesset vote in support of the nation state law, which formally defines Palestinian citizens of Israel as second class. This is really the only game in town because it gives people like me and you and people who are listening to this show something to do and a way to get out in their communities and to take on apartheid. And it's why the Israeli government has defined it as one of the key strategic threats to the state of Israel and its intentions towards Palestinians. So, I mean, that really, if that doesn't tell you how important BDS is, I don't know what will. But it's important, you know, to learn about it. You can just go to bdsmovement.net. You can follow electronicintifada.net, mondoweiss.net. These are great sites to learn about how this movement is functioning and the threats against it. And we'll continue reporting on it at grayzoneproject.com.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. Max is a journalist, best-selling author. His latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He also, along with Dan Cohen, made the amazing movie documentary called Killing Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Gray Zone Project and the co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. Again today, we take a look at political races around the country in the run-up to midterm elections in November. We're joined here in the studio by Jacqueline Lukman. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Lukman Nation, and you can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
So before we get into the nitty-gritty of the of these races that we like love so much to talk about every week, Jackie, I want to talk about John McCain. Just a couple of hours ago, his family announced that he will no longer have any treatment for his glioblastoma, his brain cancer, and he likely will only survive another couple of days.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not you agree with John McCain's politics, and I personally like to think that there's something that everyone can agree with on John McCain at some point or another. I actually have a soft spot for John McCain because he said that had I not gone forward with the CIA's torture program information, that torture would probably still be legal in America. And so I was very grateful for his support in what were dark days for me personally.
Yeah, definitely.
But let's talk about the practicality of John McCain no longer being on the scene. Mm-hmm. Now, most state laws are the same when it comes to replacing a United States senator.
Right.
In most cases, the governor makes a temporary appointment. That appointment can last from a day to, you know, 5 years and 364 days.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, then there has to be an election. Sometimes it's a special election. Sometimes it's an election that's timed with the next regularly scheduled election. Either way, there's going to be some upheaval in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're not talking about the upheaval that we're already seeing in Arizona to replace Senator Jeff Flake.
Right.
What we're talking about is replacing two United States senators in Arizona, both Republicans, at the same time.
Right.
What do you make of that?
In any other election cycle, midterm cycle, this would be almost a non-story. Right. It would just be like
nobody
you said,
would pay any attention.
Yeah, it would just be, you know, typical procedural. This is just what happens when these things happen. But because we're in the Trump era, this is a very different story where the Democrats are seeing an opportunity that was born out of partially of, you know, one seat, a very tragic consequence. You know, like you said, regardless how you feel about McCain's policies, everybody hates cancer. So, you know, but the Democrats are seeing the vacancy of the McCain and the Flake seats as opportunities for them to seize or regain power in Congress. But the interesting thing, and that's not interesting, right? That's obvious.
Right.
But the interesting thing is the infighting in the Republican Party, where you have the potential replacements for both Flake and McCain being either, it's odd that McCain and Flake type Republicans are considered moderates.
Yeah.
Now.
Because if you ask McCain or Flake, neither one of them would describe themselves as moderates.
No, they're very conservative Republican. We all know McCain's record on war. It's very interesting to see the infighting that's fomenting in the Republican Party on who will replace McCain. And basically the litmus test is whether that person supports Trump or not.
That's what it's going to come down to.
Yeah. And as much as I don't agree with much of the Republican Party platform, I think that is that's sad for the Republican Party, that that's their litmus test now. It's gotten that low.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I want to also talk about this race, this special election that we saw in Ohio 2 weeks ago, just outside of Columbus. This was a race between the Republican Troy Balderson and the Democrat Danny O'Connor. Now, no Democrats ever won this race, ever, since the district was created. And the race, as I said a moment ago, was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Well, we just found out in the last hour. Who won?
The Democrat.
The Republican.
Really?
The Republican pulled it out. So Troy Balderson has been declared the winner by the Ohio Secretary of State. He won by 0.8% of the vote.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's 1,680 votes. Now, if that doesn't speak to voter turnout, I don't know what does.
It really does.
This is a district in which Donald Trump won more than 62% of the vote.
And
the Republicans were able to hang on to it with a totally mainstream candidate. I mean, really, Troy Balderson had no real negatives for that district.
Yeah.
He was tailor-made for that district.
Yeah.
And he won it by 0.8% of the vote.
Yeah.
What does that say about the rest of these special elections that we're seeing around the country?
These very tight races, no matter who wins them, and this is what I'm beginning to feel about all of these races that are as tight as they are, and they should not be. They will always be, they'll be looked at as victories, right? For it's like football, and I think we've said this before, like in a tight football game, and it's ugly the whole time. There are penalties all over the place. Both teams suck, and it just so happens one team wins the game by a field goal because the other team had some horrible penalty, this stupid penalty at the last, you know, the last 3 minutes of the game. And the coach will come on after the game and say, well, you know, it was an ugly win, but it was a win. That's the way these races feel. That's the way they look and feel. And that's the way either party is going to play them. It doesn't matter to them that they won by 0.8 of a percentage.
That's right.
The only thing that matters to them is that they won, that is that they held on to the seat. But the problem for the voters, and we've been saying this for weeks, the problem for the voters is that the policy doesn't change. The nothing, people don't get anything extra for that ugly win, right? And other than bragging rights to say, my party held on to this seat. For the Republicans in this particular race, yeah, they can do a little bit of a victory lap after wiping the sweat from their brow, I'm sure. But the Democrats had really better start looking at how closely they're losing and start to really focus on that grassroots door knocking voter turnout effort. Because say what you want about Republican voters, they show up to the polls.
They do. More than Democratic voters
do. More than they do.
It's interesting that you say that, too, because this is a theme that we're seeing across the state of Ohio right now. First, let me wrap up this Balderson issue. So Balderson and O'Connor are going to face each other again in November.
That's right.
This race was just for the special election. So Balderson is only going to be the congressman for September and October.
Let's see how much damage he can do.
And they're going to have to do the whole thing over again in November. Again, it's all about turnout.
It really is. And if the Democrats don't figure that out, and they can do it, if they don't figure that out in between now and then they don't deserve to win.
Amen.
That seat.
So let's talk about another Ohio race. This is Steve Chabot. Steve Chabot's been around forever. Suburban Cincinnati. He's been in the House of Representatives for 22 years.
Oh, wow.
He's running scared right now. And he said so to Politico. There's a 35-year-old guy named Aftab Puraval, who is the Cincinnati, the Hamilton County, Ohio clerk of courts. He's very popular. He's a terrific campaigner. He's young and energetic and aggressive, and he runs TV commercials using sort of a twin of the Aflac duck, making fun of his name, saying Aftab, Aftab. People love it.
A little self-deprecating humor. People love that. Yeah.
But the point of his campaign is that Steve Chabot is living like a fat cat in Washington, D.C. He doesn't even live in Ohio anymore. He's got a house here in Washington.
Wow.
He's been in for 22 years. He never goes back home to campaign. He hasn't had a town hall meeting in a decade.
Wow.
And the guy's just out of touch. And so now Chabot is saying, oh, I've made some mistakes. I better get back home and campaign. But it's not just Steve Chabot. It's the likes of, well, Politico is pointing out Dana Rohrabacher in California, who's always on a short list of losing. Or Leonard Lance of New Jersey, or John Culberson of Texas. We're talking about guys with more than 100 years of combined experience in the House of Representatives who now are panicking because they thought they were in safe seats.
Right.
Right. And they're actually not in safe seats.
And they shouldn't be. They absolutely shouldn't be in safe seats, because you know how much society changes in 20 years? I mean, obviously we do. But when you don't even live in the district you represent, you have no idea. Now, I'm a resident of the District of Columbia, and I always like to point out that the District of Columbia is very different from Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. what people who don't live here
That's right.
identify as Washington, D.C.
It's two completely different worlds.
Right. We're talking about Capitol Hill and K Street, the lobbyists, and everybody else who lives in this city.
That's right.
I don't want, as a resident of the District of Columbia, my representatives to live in Potomac, Maryland, because they have no idea what life is like for district residents. Potomac is less than 20 miles from here, but it's a very different community. And it and both communities change over time. If that's true of two communities that are this close to each other, how much more true is that for somewhere out in Ohio and Texas? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so how do you keep your finger on the pulse of the people you're supposed to be representing mm-hmm. when you live hundreds of miles away from all of those people most of the days of the year?
That's right.
And I think for many people who don't delve into politics like we do, right, every week and every day, honestly, that their decision on who they vote for honestly comes down to that. How out of touch their elected officials are. Do they know them? Can they walk into their office when they have a problem, or can they pick up the phone and will they get a call back? And if over a certain period of time they can't, then they don't want those people representing them anymore, because they haven't.
You know, one of the things politicians seem to forget too is that their constituents, even if they win, their constituents are not necessarily in love with them.
Right.
I worked for a guy on Capitol Hill. It was my first political job. This is in the early 1980s. House of Representatives, a congressman, a Democratic congressman by the name of Joe Colter. Joe was he had been a state rep. He was a manager of a bowling alley. Mm-hmm. And he got himself elected to Congress. So what did he know about writing bills? Nothing.
Right, right.
But everybody loved Joe. He was a guy that would give you a good slap on the back and ask you how your kids were doing. And mm-hmm. people just loved him. But then he came to Washington, and he got wrapped up in the whole idea of power. And he began stealing.
Mm-hmm.
So he began buying stamps on his house account from mm-hmm. the House Post Office. Mm-hmm. And selling the stamps and pocketing the cash.
What?
And then his top aide, his office director, began doing the same thing, but he was trading his stamps for cocaine.
Wow.
And then it came time when the FBI interviewed all of us in the office mm-hmm. and people started to flip mm-hmm. and point fingers.
Sure.
And Joe lost his next primary. He actually came in fourth. And he was so angry that on election night, the winner of the primary, and who went on to become the congressman, a guy named Ron Klink. Mm-hmm. Ron was the local weatherman.
Oh, I think I remember Ron Klink.
Ron was,
and I remember him because his name was so unusual. Yeah,
it is, yeah. So Ron was the local Channel 4 weatherman in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. and they had him on a split screen with Joe. And Joe was so angry at having lost, he couldn't believe that he had lost this race. Despite the fact that he had been indicted on multiple felony charges, he said to Ron Klink, "I am going to stick to you like glue when you're in Washington." And Ron Klink retorted, "Good. Maybe you'll learn something about how to be a good congressman."
Wow. Wow.
You know, that story has always stuck in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because so many of these guys forget where they came from.
Yes.
And they forget that they're not kings
yes.
or queens.
Right.
They're not special.
Mm-hmm.
They're hired help.
Exactly.
And they're here to do a job.
Precisely.
And if they don't do the job, they get fired mm-hmm. and somebody else will do the job.
Exactly.
And I think this is one of those years where a lot of people are going to get fired.
Yeah, I think it is. And it's been a long time coming. What people don't understand, and that's a great story. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think people don't understand how special elected officials are treated when they get to Congress.
Oh, they are. They have a special parking lot at National Airport that's
yes.
practically next to the door.
I mean, these are people who, I mean, lunch is an important thing for me. So when I first saw like the congressional cafeteria, the guy, I was just like, this is, all I have to do is get elected to office to get free food like this, you know. So it's this kind of a red carpet rock star treatment that we're not talking about the taxpayers who are flowering on these people. We're talking about lobbyists, people who represent these special interest groups that they want these people to pass legislation on behalf of, and they really now it's gotten better than it used to be. There are no more, at least on the record, three martini lunches at Old
Those
Ebbets Grill
That's
like
right.
there used to be because of all kinds of different reforms. But there is still a lot of preferential treatment, a lot of financially based favors and all of this special, you know, you're special and you're wonderful and you are going to be our saviors kind of treatment
yeah.
that elected officials get in Washington that they're not going to get in their small towns that they represent.
Yep.
And that is corrupting for some people.
I think you're absolutely right. We have a lot of races to talk about. There are two that I put on our little schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna take less than 30 seconds to go over them because you have some important ones you want to talk about. I wanted to talk just very quickly about the North Dakota Senate race.
Mm-hmm.
North Dakota Senate race, we've talked about a number of times. This is Heidi Heitkamp, who's
yeah.
the incumbent Democrat. She's running against Representative Kevin Cramer, who is the lone House member in the state of North Dakota. It's
right.
a big state. Nobody actually lives there, so they get one,
right.
one House seat.
Them and the Buffalo.
It's funny to me that Cramer, every time he's anywhere near a reporter, will complain that nobody likes him, especially the president.
Yeah.
And so he's pretty much just conceding this mm-hmm. race. Now, mm-hmm. interestingly, Heitkamp won by less than 1% of the vote in mm-hmm. 2012. And her victory was a big upset because the Republicans were supposed to win that race. Well, now you've got Donald Trump complimenting her and the Democrats seem to love her. And even though there are no Democrats in North Dakota
mm-hmm.
for all intents and purposes,
right.
it looks like she's going to win this race. Now, there's a recent poll that shows her winning by 8 percentage points.
Hmm.
But there's also a recent poll that now shows him winning by 4 percentage points.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Cory Gardner, in a recent interview, he's the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. He said that Heitkamp is the most vulnerable senator in America. And he said that North Dakota is the number one top Republican target. Do you agree with that?
I agree that she is the most vulnerable politician in America, but she always is.
More than Heller.
I think
in
more
Nevada.
Than, yeah, yeah. I think,
really?
Well, because I think that she kind of has a track record. She and McCaskill, I think, have this neck and neck track record of just barely winning.
Barely.
Just, you know.
McCaskill is like the undead.
Yeah.
Just when you declare her dead, she crawls back out of the ground and wins the race.
And that's only because of a forced error by the Republicans.
Every time.
And I think this is the same thing. You know, Heitkamp didn't have to do anything after Trump praised her.
Yep.
She pretty much didn't have to do anything other than not screw up.
That's it.
Basically.
That's
and
it.
And that's what she did. So, and that that is what makes her vulnerable.
That's it.
So I agree with half of that.
Well, I wanted to raise one other issue. And I'll admit that I don't know a lot about this race. It's
mm-hmm.
the Wyoming Republican nomination race for governor.
Hmm.
Yeah. So the only reason I even raise it is because Donald Trump seems to enjoy jumping into a race in the last 24 hours.
Oh, doesn't
making
he?
A last minute endorsement and just seeing what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so far, every time he's done that, the person that he's endorsed has won. And we've seen several Republican incumbents fall because of an early morning or late night tweet coming from Donald Trump. He did it again in Wyoming, and he endorsed a multimillionaire mega donor to his campaign by the name of Foster Freese. And Foster Freese lost. That's the first time. So I'm wondering, are people getting a little tired of Donald Trump pitting Republicans against each other? Or is Foster Freese just a nobody who was trying to buy the governor's race?
I think the latter
mm-hmm.
is more true. Because I think people underestimate what's going on with Donald Trump. It's not that he's so great. It's that the people who support him are more populist than most of us are comfortable with admitting, right? So if Donald Trump says, hey, vote for this person, more people than we want to admit will actually do what he says. That's not because Trump is such a genius.
Sure.
It's because that many crazy people believe this man. That's just true.
Yep.
But I think it is also true, like we said, that most voters in this country, regardless of their political stripes, are really annoyed with filthy rich people trying to buy more political power. And yep. And I think that this Freeze person, who I had never heard of him, he just fell victim to his own, what do you want to call it, hubris, I guess?
That has to be it. It's his own hubris.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Simpson, who had endorsed another one of the whole bunch of Republican candidates, he said it very plainly. He said, he has plenty of jack, meaning money. He has plenty of jack, and he's willing to spend every cent of it. Every cent of it.
Mm.
We'll see whether you can really buy a governor's race.
Apparently.
And the answer is no.
The answer is no. Not in Wyoming anyway.
Now, you sent me an email, Jackie, earlier in the week in which you you laid out a whole bunch of different races. And I'm looking at them. Every one of them is important. And I wondered if you could walk us through a couple of them.
So I think the two races in Arizona are really, really interesting. The race between Leah Marquez Peterson, the Republican, and Martha McSally, the Republican, that's another case of which Republican is more Republican in the Trump era, which is, I think, is ridiculous, because you have Leah Marquez Peterson, who is a woman who is campaigning on Trump policies without actually sort of mentioning his name, because, of course, she can't justify his sexism, you know. So but she's defending his racist comments about immigrants, but she's not courting endorsements for him. So she's trying to ride the Trump wave without mentioning Trump. And at the same time, she's pointing to fellow Republican Martha McSally, who is a combat veteran, and saying that she's not Republican enough. Why? Because she wore a pink tutu at some kind of speaking event. So that's a very interesting race where, you know, we're seeing especially two Republican women duking it out in the Trump era and how they're handling that.
And Joe Arpaio is in the mix there too, right?
Just barely. He's just kind of off on his weird, fringy. Republicans don't even take him seriously anymore, which, thank God. So, you know, that is very interesting. Also the Arizona Senate race between Kelly Ward and Jeff Flake, that's very interesting also, because like we have said earlier, this idea that Flake and McCain and Republicans who have long established Republican credentials are not seen as Republican enough anymore. And Kelly Ward, who's running to replace Jeff Flake, actually said at some campaign event, do you want to send someone else to Washington who's like John McCain? And that the crowd said no. So I'm just wondering, well, I'm not wondering. It's frightening the kind of people these Trump supporters want to send to replace. I mean, the established Republicans were bad enough. You know, now they just want to send people in there with flamethrowers.
Yeah, the rightward drift. I mean, really, it's the Republican Party, but it's also U.S. politics as a whole, right?
True.
And for sure, I think the forces in the Republican Party in a lot of cases are the ones in sort of the driver's seat of that right wing push. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had the Tea Party in 2010. But
right.
But now, I mean, the sort of Trump people are further to the right there. Mm-hmm. And then the Democratic Party establishment, their position is, OK, well, we got to play to the center. So let's move like a little bit further
right.
to the right, but not quite as far. And we'll be a little bit less bad than the other guys.
Right. So then you end up with two right leaning parties.
Yeah,
basically. And then everybody else who are considered communists.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so the gap between I think the gap between like U.S. public opinion on a lot of these key issues and the, you know, the political consensus in terms of like the political class, like Congress and the politicians and the career politicians. It's the chasm kind of widens. And I think that's why, you know, there are openings for people, you know, like whatever deficiencies there may be on issues of foreign policy for people like, you know, Bernie Sanders or, you know, some of the the Democratic Socialist candidates who have won primaries in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just when people are trying to push the Democratic Party left, and it's not that we're trying to push the Democratic Party further left, we're just trying to get them back left, you know, where they were supposed to be, then the natural political response is a hard, hard right.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and that's, you know, which of course the natural political response to that is a hard left. So that's basically what we're seeing.
Yeah, I saw Nancy Pelosi speaking, I think it was a couple of days ago, but it was somebody brought up the point about like, oh, a lot of people are talking about abolishing ICE, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is like a pretty reasonable response to like
Absolutely.
Locking children in cages and kidnapping them and taking them away from
yes.
their families.
Yeah.
But at the end she was just like, oh no, that's what the Republicans want us to say. We'll never say that we're for abolishing ICE.
So you'll never say that you're going to get rid of an organization that whose purpose is to disrupt the lives of people. Oh, yeah, I can't keep doing that with the Democrats.
Yeah.
So when we look at these other races, when I look at the race in Ohio for governor between Kasich. It's interesting to me that
Cordray is the Democrat in that one.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even paying attention to him as much as I was paying to John Kasich and the things that he's been saying, because Kasich is like this nice guy Republican to a lot of Democrats.
That's his brand. Yeah. That's his. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like he and Larry Hogan are like the two nice guy Republicans in the country, where Democrats are like, yeah, I could vote for those, you know, those guys for president. The problem with someone like John Kasich, aside from the fact that he is a Republican, is his actual policies, right? So in a recent GOP, this week, there's a GOP fundraiser today. Now, this is the kind of thing that makes Kasich seem like a reasonable guy and then just causes you to completely ignore his actual policies. He intends to skip this GOP fundraiser today, later on tonight, in Ohio that Trump is speaking at. Now, this is the first time Trump has ever, or any sitting president, has ever spoken at this particular fundraiser. And Kasich has come out, he's been very critical of Trump, and he's come out and said, look, more GOP politicians need to be critical of him. But, you know, he came out and he said, I'm not going to this fundraiser because Trump is there. Now, that makes him seem very reasonable. And, you know, people who are anti-Trump are very much, oh, yay, go Kasich. But then you ignore the policies that this guy supports. And it's that kind of a soft sort of alliance, I guess, or a soft allyship is a good I think a good term I can think of that we fall for sometimes, where we're thinking that, oh, people like Kasich, they're the good guys. No, they're just opposing this one bad guy.
Yeah, I mean, under Kasich's governorship, I think he supported one of these like horrible fetal heartbeat laws,
yes.
where like anti-choice fanatic.
Yes.
I mean, stuff that like people in who are I completely agree with you.
Yeah. Just,
I think we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. You can check out their podcast. Check out Lookman Nation on Facebook. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.